Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, U.S. troops are reported to be within 30, 25, even 19 miles of Baghdad. Those could still be long, bloody miles. But it's time to think again about exactly how this war can end. Washington says nothing less than unconditional surrender will do. But whose surrender? And will that mean the end? Tonight on Point, defining victory in Iraq. We begin with an assessment of fast-moving developments on the war front. Troops are moving closer to Baghdad, and U.S. commanders today described a heavy toll taken on Saddam's Republican Guard. Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him what he made of today's advances.
First of all, we mustn't get too excited about this. The important thing is that there is now momentum again, and they appear to be doing well. But they could run up against all sorts of things over the next couple of days. And we've got to be realistic. I mean, they're getting closer to Baghdad. As they get much, much closer, then there are going to be more obstacles placed in their way. But they've got momentum again, and that's really, really good news. And it's good for their morale as well. And these things have a habit of multiplying. And certainly they're on the way. There are significant casualties amongst two Republican Guard divisions. And we would expect to see them on the outskirts of Baghdad, possibly into the suburbs of Baghdad, probably on Saturday at the latest Sunday.
U.S. officials saying today that the Medina and Baghdad divisions are no longer credible fighting forces. The headline shorthand is they've been smashed. They're out of commission. We heard a lot about the Medina division in recent days of it as a significant fighting force.
As ever, I'm going to say let's just take a step backwards and let's just see how the next couple of days go. Now, there is no doubt that severe damage has been inflicted on both of those divisions. But soldiers have a way of managing to regroup and get themselves into some sort of battle order again. And we really must see what happens tomorrow. Now, then, those divisions are certainly not going to be in the same fighting state tomorrow as they were, say, at the beginning of this morning. But we really need to look at tomorrow's events and just see if some of those troops can reform themselves and if they can maybe make some attacks on coalition supply lines. So we really have to look at tomorrow. But at the moment, the omens look good.
The commander of British forces in Iraq, Air Marshal Brian Burridge, noting that this sense of a decisive phase of the war has arrived, said the point I would make, though, is that decisive phases often take time. If we may see U.S. troops in the suburbs of Baghdad tomorrow, what does that mean about time?
Well, it basically means that this operation is going to plan. If they're there tomorrow, you could not have expected them to have been there any faster. I mean, all the people who were saying at the beginning of this operation they'll be there in 3 or 4 days really, really need to go back to military basics school. I mean, these guys have done a tremendous amount already. To criticize them for not being there in 3 or 4 days and having to fight their way through the opposition is quite frankly crazy. Now, I wrote an article on day one of the war saying expect them to be around the outskirts of Baghdad in 14 days. I mean, I was ridiculed for that at the time. Well, I may be 2 or 3 days out in that it might take about 15 to 16 days. But I reckon they're on time. They're doing as well as anyone could ever be expected to do.
There's been an awful lot of criticism in recent days and lots of issues raised and worries about long supply lines and about reinforcements needed. Are those still issues or have those issues somehow melted away?
No, those issues haven't gone away because there are still long exposed supply lines. Now, what we must hope is that the Fedayeen who have been attacking those supply lines have gone through their first initial out of enthusiasm, and that these attacks will now tail off. But no one knows for certain. Reinforcements are very, very important. The guys up in the fighting areas need to be reinforced as quickly as possible. They have been going hard at it now for 14 days, and they need some sort of relief. You can't expect them to go on forever. And quite frankly, if they're not reinforced within a week or so, I would be very, very worried about them. They must be really mentally and getting very near to being physically exhausted.
But we're told that the bulk of those potential reinforcements remain weeks away. Meanwhile, the military is probing right into to the heart of Iraq, to the heart of Saddam's regime and territory. What does that say? Does it say they plan to go the distance without reinforcements, so that somehow they can speed up reinforcement?
Well, first of all, I hope they don't plan to go the distance without reinforcements. That's when you start to take more casualties than you would have taken otherwise, especially when guys get totally exhausted. They can actually move 101 Airborne Division up. As far as I can make out, 101 have been fighting for about 4 days now around Nasiriyah, but they will probably be not quite as exhausted as the guys in the 3rd Infantry and the 1st Marine. So there are some reinforcements there. There's a fresh British brigade, 16 Airborne Brigade, which I think is being used as a strategic reserve at the moment. That can move up and help out. They may have to get some people from maybe the 4th Infantry Division up into that area, maybe without armoured personnel carriers, but as lightly armed infantry troops in the first instance.
Just to freshen the ranks. And what can we expect then the next few days of the war to look like as troops close around Baghdad?
Once they get up to Baghdad and they close around Baghdad, then we're in for another period of consolidation where they really establish their positions around Baghdad before they decide how they're going to tackle the city. But it begins to look as though Baghdad really will be tackled in the same way as Basra is being tackled at the moment. We had an interesting brief from the commander of the 1st British Division today, who was talking about his tactics in Basra. And he quite rightly pointed out that he's fighting three wars in Basra. He's fighting a war against the Fedayeen in the area of Basra, which is getting better by the day. He's fighting another war inside Basra against the regular Iraqi forces. But last and not least, he's fighting a humanitarian war here as well. I mean, okay, we know that the coalition can win the war. That's a given. That's going to happen. But we have to win the peace as well. If we don't win the peace, then all this sacrifice is just wasted. And part of winning the peace, I'm afraid, is winning that humanitarian war at the same time. And somehow, and it's going to be very, very difficult, we have to bring the bulk of the Iraqi population on side. And we're not going to do that until we root out the Ba'ath Party.
So, Charles Heyman, when is this war won? How is winning defined here?
It's never going to be a war that you win outright. I think it's going to be a war that you win by phases. And phase one is surrounding Baghdad. Once you've taken control of Baghdad and you've got rid of Saddam Hussein, then you've actually won another phase. And then the next phase is the pacification of the countryside and the rooting out of the Ba'ath Party. And then you've won that bit. And then if you can get a government in that actually works, and the country looks reasonably stable in the long time, then you can say, we've won.
And Donald Rumsfeld's requirement of unconditional surrender, do you expect that that will speed or delay the first phase of winning here?
Well, I hate to criticize the American Secretary of State. It's not my job to do that, being British. But I always feel that when you make demands, cast iron demands, you box yourself in. It's almost like saying the great thing about Osama bin Laden. We are going to get Osama bin Laden. And I was saying, for goodness sake, don't say that, because if you don't get him in the short term, it makes us all look stupid. Again, saying it's got to be unconditional surrender. We are boxed in straight away. We may not have anyone who's going to surrender unconditionally to us. And it's a really, really difficult thing. We should just say we need to win the war. And at the end of the day, the measurement of what we've won will be if we can actually put a reasonable government into that country and give the people a chance for the future.
Charles Heyman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Major Charles Heyman served 30 years in the British military. He is now editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with me from Shrewsbury, England. The new message from CENTCOM: the troops are closing in on Baghdad. The final leg could be long and costly, but part of that length may be determined by exactly how Washington defines victory. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday at a Pentagon briefing that the only thing that the coalition will discuss with this regime is their unconditional surrender. But whose surrender exactly? Saddam's? And what if he's dead or gone? The whole Ba'ath Party? Is that possible? Anticipated terms of surrender can shorten a war or make it very difficult to end. We're looking this hour at war in Iraq and exactly how we will know when it's over. What would it take for you to declare victory in Iraq? Saddam and his sons out of power, regime change, U.S. troops back home. When will we know the war is really won? If armed opposition goes on, can the U.S. declare victory? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Mike Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine and author of the forthcoming book, At War With Ourselves. Good evening and welcome, Mike Hirsch.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us, Mike. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack. Good to have you here.
Hello, Tom.
Mike Hirsch, take us inside this unconditional demand that Donald Rumsfeld has made. How is the Pentagon, how is Washington and the leadership there envisioning exactly what victory means in Iraq and how they'll define it to themselves and the world?
Well, you have it at different levels. You start off on one very concrete unconditional level, which is the departure or death of Saddam and his sons and a few very senior people around him and the destruction of the Ba'ath Party. That there is no negotiation over that, and the Bush administration has already put themselves out there saying so. So that's final.
But Mike Hirsch, let me ask you, even at that point, it's not so difficult to imagine the ouster of three people, of Saddam and his and his two sons. But you kind of glossed over the destruction of the Ba'ath Party. It's a huge party.
Exactly.
It's wall-to-wall inside Iraq.
Right.
Exactly what is this unconditional surrender demand saying to the Ba'ath Party and its thousands, I don't know, millions of members?
Well, that's when it does start to get hazy and when unconditionality starts to become something that is perhaps more negotiable. The reason being, the nightmare scenario for U.S. and British forces is to be faced with, trying to oust Saddam and at the same time battling dozens or scores of insurgencies, not just in Baghdad but other cities, by Ba'ath Party loyalists and Fedayeen and others who know they have no life after the Saddam regime and therefore have no real motivation to surrender. And the question will become, once the U.S. feels it has Saddam and his top people out of the way, does it then offer some kind of an amnesty to others to get them to surrender so the U.S. Occupation forces and British occupation forces don't find themselves, fighting a month or possibly even years long, insurgency by those who are still holding out?
And this unconditional surrender demand, was it specifically put out to shorten the war somehow? Is it a statement to Iraqis or to the world? Does it leave room for generals around Saddam Hussein to mount a coup and hope to bargain for something?
Very much so. I mean, I think this was a message that one way or another Saddam is going to be gone. If you want to put a bullet in his head, that's fine. If he wants to try to leave the country secretly, well, we'll accept that for the moment. We're still going to go after him. As Bush said, his initial 48-hour offer for Saddam to leave the country is no longer valid. But the point is, this is a message to the Iraqi people and to those surrounding Saddam as much as it is to the rest of the world. This is the base condition for U.S. Of U.S. terms for surrender.
Jack Beatty, the design of a home stretch, the design of a conclusion, can affect how that home stretch goes.
Oh, it sure can. And here, we're facing the Battle of Baghdad, and already a general said the other day, very heavy American casualties, and inevitably it's going to offer a catastrophic tableau of civilian suffering and grief. Anything that avoids that and gets Saddam out is a great gain for America. And, terms, you can set up terms of surrender such that you can stimulate dynamics within Iraq to do the job with Saddam for you. You can offer bribes, you can offer amnesties to the people around him, and you can go back to Saddam Hussein and go back to the Jordanian proposal, which was to allow him to a kind of protected exile guaranteed by George Bush. Again, not ideal, but if it saves this unnecessary suffering a great boon.
Hard to imagine at this point, but we're talking about tonight. What constitutes victory? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about defining victory in Iraq, unconditional surrender, regime change, and how this war will end. What will constitute victory in this war in your mind? Is unconditional surrender necessary to victory, to ending Saddam's regime? Or would a more flexible definition make winning less costly? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Michael Hirsch. He's senior editor of Newsweek magazine, author of the forthcoming book, At War With Ourselves. And now from New York City by Leon Siegel. He's director of the Northeast Asia Cooperative Security Project for the Social Science Research Council and author of Fighting to a Finish, The Politics of War Termination in the United States and Japan, 1945. Good evening and welcome, Leon Siegel.
Thanks for having me.
Leon Siegel and Mike Hirsch, I hope you'll stand by while we listen back for just a moment to Donald Rumsfeld at yesterday's Pentagon briefing with the buildup and laydown of this term, unconditional surrender.
The circumstance of the regime is such that Iraqi officials are spreading rumors that the coalition has entered into a ceasefire negotiation with the regime and that there's a third-party peace plan under consideration. Their goal is to try to convince the people of Iraq that the coalition does not intend to finish the job. Since this broadcast is sent into Iraq, let me say this to all Iraqis who are listening. The regime is not telling the truth. There are no negotiations taking place with anyone in the Saddam Hussein's regime. There will be no outcome to this war that leaves Saddam Hussein and his regime in power. Let there be no doubt. His time will end, and soon. The only thing that the coalition will discuss with this regime is their unconditional surrender.
Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon's briefing yesterday afternoon with his explanation of the demand of unconditional surrender. Leon Siegel, you spent years studying how wars end, right down in the nitty-gritty, in the dynamics of ending a war. How is Donald Rumsfeld setting up the end of this war in your mind?
Well, first of all, he's ruling out a negotiated settlement with the regime. He's not ruling out surrenders of our army units. He may not even be ruling out surrender by Fedayeen or Baathist. It's not clear. Mm-hmm. But he is saying we're not going to negotiate with Saddam. And I mean, this arose because people are anticipating a problem down the road. And it arose not because Donald Rumsfeld said so. The president and the prime minister negotiated that a couple of days ago.
That being?
The problem is there is a relationship between how you use military force at the end of a war and what kind of war aims you can pursue and whether or not you seek a negotiated settlement. Those three aspects. And they are related.
We're clearly using military force if this is what you call the end of the war.
Well, we're not. We're using it much more carefully than we did, for instance, in World War II, because part of our problem is that if we use all the military force at our disposal, mm-hmm. we're likely to be killing a lot of civilians. Mm-hmm. That has two extremely unfortunate consequences. One is within Iraq itself, how you then get a post-war occupation that isn't very difficult to manage. But the second is the larger frame, which is throughout the Middle East. This war threatens enormous destabilization, and it is particularly sensitive, we suspect, to perceptions of civilian casualties on television.
So how does an unconditional surrender demand relate to those concerns?
Okay. First, how militarily will we capture Baghdad? Consider three possibilities. One is that we shatter the Republican Guard defending outside Baghdad, mm-hmm. and the regime falls apart. Okay, that's one possibility.
Falls apart, meaning what? Saddam gets on an airplane and flies nowhere?
No, meaning lots of defectors in mm-hmm. the high ranks, okay. even if Saddam doesn't defect. But
isolated in his bunker, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. A second is that we have to go in with military force into the city. Obviously, that increases not only the civilian casualties, but also U.S. casualties. And if we have a lot of U.S. casualties, war aims have a tendency to get, larger rather than smaller, because you have to justify all those deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And the third possibility is that you're going to lay siege to Baghdad. Now, that also has civilian casualties, but perhaps not as visible, because people are going to suffer from lack of water and lack of food.
So from your historical perspective, is this unconditional surrender the right way to go here, the only way to go here, or not?
Consider the possibility that we're laying siege and people are starting to die, or we're in Baghdad and we're fighting our way into Baghdad and people are dying in large numbers. Mm-hmm. At that point, there is going to be pressure on us from all governments in the Middle East to end this thing in a hurry. What the president doesn't want to do, obviously, is have to negotiate some kind of ending with Saddam, because we're starting to get destabilization in other Middle Eastern governments. And so he and the prime minister have agreed, we're just going to insist on unconditional surrender. We're not going to negotiate with him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, the practical problem is that may mean that we have to fight a rather bitter end war. We don't know that. Okay.
Mike Hirsch, let me bring you back in for just a minute. Please stand by, Leon Siegel. Mike, you're watching this firsthand in Washington, the debate over this. Is the betting weighed one way or another here? Are people expecting a surrender, siege, regime collapse, or a bloody march right to the heart of things?
Well, you know, after a lot of dashed expectations, they're not sure what they believe. But the main reason for the demand for unconditional surrender at this juncture is one of the things that Bush administration officials are most concerned about is how beholden Iraqi people are, how frightened they are by the Fedayeen and other instruments of Saddam's terror. The important thing is to convey the message that this regime is not going to be allowed to stay intact as it was after the 1991 Gulf War. That is the critical breakpoint with the past here that the Bush administration wants to pursue. And that is to send the message, by hook or crook, if you're a Saddam general and you put a bullet in his head, fine. If you are a member, just an Iraqi citizen of Baghdad, we are going to come in. This man is not going to be permitted to remain. Everything after that remains undefined.
But that's the absolute bottom line, as Don Rumsfeld laid it out yesterday, and you're seconding that as the broader view there as well tonight. Mike Hirsch, I know we have to let you go, but we thank you for joining us. It's been great having you.
Happy to be here.
Michael Hirsch is senior editor at Newsweek magazine and author of the forthcoming At War With Ourselves. Jack Beatty, here we are. The table is being set for some great, we hope, final chapter in this war. You hear Leon Siegel, who studied surrenders in many countries, in many wars, walking through the details of how this works. Can you really imagine a suitable outcome or an acceptable outcome to Washington other than unconditional surrender that allows the kind of reengineering of a country that's been dominated by Saddam Hussein for so long, or at least the hope of reengineering?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important now that we try to have the Iraqis play that card one more time to see if the security apparatus around him, what part of it is detachable? How can we turn that against him? And it seems to me that if you use the unconditional surrender and you stay by that, that's not the message that's going to get people to come over on your side. Now, we know that in Afghanistan, bribes were terribly important in detaching, in sort of setting up the Northern Alliance and making that work. And even in, I don't know that it did much with the Taliban, but it certainly helped to put together the coalition. Bribes are a possibility to the people around Saddam, as are amnesties. And if carrots don't work, there are also sticks. You know, we know where these people live. We know where Tariq Aziz lives. And in 1991, the atrocity, the bombing of that Well, it turned actually it was a shelter where daycare center was people and the children and women from the daycare center were hiding.
With the command center underneath.
Killed 300 and some odd women and children. Well, you know, they didn't aim. They didn't know that the women and children were going to be there, but they knew there was a daycare center around there, and they knew that it was where the regime's children went. And as soon as that came down, very shortly after that, Iraq agreed to peace terms. People's children were being killed. Now, that's quite a threat to say to somebody, to say to them, well, if the carrot won't work, here are bribes, here are amnesties, maybe the stick will work. We know where you live. And if you can't, if that isn't enough to get you to league with your colleagues and remove this man, then you're facing a very grim scenario.
Jack Beatty, Leon Siegel, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Newport, Rhode Island, Tom Nichols. He's chairman of the Department of Strategy and Policy at the Naval War College. Good evening and welcome, Tom Nichols.
Good evening.
We're talking about terms of surrender, about how this war gets ended tonight. Tom Nichols, in your view, is there a more open offer that ought to be out there than unconditional surrender, or is that the only way to end this, and how do we come to a clean and something like final end to this war?
No, absolutely not. The demand has to be unconditional surrender, and there's one other reason for that, and that is to the Iraqis that are watching to see what will happen, to see if this is going to be a replay of 1991, where they began to rebel against the Iraqis and against the Saddam Hussein regime, and then only to find that they were being hung out to dry when we couldn't protect them and we had to withdraw. They're waiting to see how serious are we about this. And I think saying, look, we will not accept anything but the unconditional surrender of the regime, not of the entire Iraqi people, but of the regime, I think that's the only way to make clear both to the regime and to the people of Iraq that we're absolutely serious about this. And I disagree very strongly that somehow this is going to simply harden resistance among the people around Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. Their resistance couldn't get any harder than it already is. They know that these are people that know they have no future. These are people that know that somehow there's not going to be a deal cut where somehow Saddam steps to the side or his son stepped to the side and some Ba'athist hack steps up and creates a kind of sham interim government. I think they understand fully that basically the only option here is either to surrender and hope for humane treatment or to stay where they are and get killed, or to somehow stay where they are and get killed by their own people at some point.
Leon Siegel, is this just where we want this regime? Are there lessons we can draw from surrenders in earlier large wars? You've looked closely at Japan and I'm sure at others. Does history give us any signposts to follow here?
History suggests that we're not going to insist on the unconditional surrender of what some people call the regime, because the regime includes a Ba'athist party that has a lot of time servers and people who wanted to get ahead, and so they joined the party. It doesn't just include the thugs we know who are doing a lot of killing right now. The regime also includes people in the army. Okay, some of whom are Saddam's allies, but some of whom are, you know, professional military. It also includes a police force, part of which did, and a security force, part of which did extrajudicial killings, beatings, etc., and are doing it now, but part of whom we're going to need a police force to police Iraq. We can't put in enough troops to occupy.
But these conditions
Iraq.
Were largely the same in Japan and Germany as World War II came to an end.
Okay.
And we had to rely on, we ended up relying on many of the people who had been the backbone of those regimes for the post-war regime. Will we do the same thing here?
We also carried out a policy of denazification after we occupied.
A limited policy of denazification and an even more limited policy in Japan. We have to recognize that this is a fight yet to come in part, but in part the key here may be to separate elements of the regime from the central characters, and that may make ending the war easier, and it also may make occupation easier.
Is the unconditional surrender requirement in line with that? Is it a problem for that? Are you agreeing it is the right path?
Let me give you a concrete historical example. Our policy was unconditional surrender of Japan, and technically Japan did sign a document, unconditional surrender, but in fact there was a kind of tacit negotiation about the future of the emperor. And many people in the U.S. government understood that to actually get the Japanese armed forces to surrender, you needed the emperor to do that. In order to run a post-war occupation, it helped to have the emperor around.
There's no emperor this time. Is there room for a side conversation?
Not this time. Saddam has to go, but Saddam is not the whole regime, and that's the tricky part of this.
Tom Nichols, I hear you there.
The whole regime is not every school teacher and engineer that carries a Ba'ath Party card either. When we're talking about unconditional surrender, we're talking about the people who can actually demand of their fellow Ba'ath Party members to lay down their weapons and to allow permissive entry of Allied forces. That doesn't mean that we have to go into every home and find out whether or not there's a Ba'ath Party functionary there who, frankly, is no threat to us or to their fellow citizens at this point, but rather to say, of those armed forces, of those paramilitaries, are they going to resist or are they going to be killed? And there's no unconditional surrender means that there's no middle ground for them. They either lay down their weapons and they are and then they are treated humanely and in accordance with the laws of war, or they are killed. There is not going to be a negotiation about whether they can keep their weapons and how many of them can stay in power, which ones of them can control which regions of the country, and so on.
Not even the kind of side conversation that we saw in Japan?
Pardon?
Not even the kind of side conversation that we saw in Japan about, well, what do we need to do to make this hold together post-war?
Well,
zero, none.
Let's face it. Japan was not unconditional surrender because the one condition the Japanese wanted, which was that the emperor remain in power, we acceded to.
And Tom Nichols, you mentioned one thing there I want to ask you about. From what you know, does the Ba'ath Party have such a structure that there are, in fact, authorities who could unconditionally surrender and send down the word to the membership that everybody's supposed to do the same and have that order, if you will, followed, have everyone fall in line with the surrender?
Well,
can that happen?
That's a real danger because right now the Ba'ath Party is organized not according to ideology, but certainly according to organization. There's something like a Stalinist party. Not like the later Communist Party of the Soviet Union, but literally like a Stalinist party or a Nazi party where there is a personalized center of power at the head of a totalitarian mass movement party. And if it becomes known throughout the party that that head has been cut off, has been captured, killed, has surrendered, is somehow neutralized, I think it may be a problem getting the word down to lower levels, but I think that will be the kind of collapse that we're talking about. It may not be unconditional surrender. It may just be chaos. Where those units simply say, okay, if the boss is gone, this is it. We're not going to get killed, you know, for Ba'athist ideology. And I think at that point, you may actually see a lot of people laying down their weapons.
Leon Siegel,
that points
just
out the heart,
yes,
of
please.
This, though.
Yes.
It is who can surrender what. Sometimes individual troops surrender on their own, and that starts to disrupt the fighting capabilities of units. In other cases, commanders can surrender their units intact. In other cases, maybe a Fedayeen commander might be able to. In some cases, a Ba'ath Party head might be able to get people under him to get surrenders. But part of the problem here is that if you have a notion that there is some one person who can order it, in the Japanese situation, there was such a person to some extent. That was the emperor.
And here there may well not be. Leon Siegel, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about defining victory in Iraq tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about defining victory in Iraq, about unconditional surrender, regime change, and how this war will actually end. Is ousting Saddam enough, or does his whole party have to march out with their hands in the air? When will we know if the U.S. has really won? In weeks? In years? If armed opposition goes on, can we declare victory? Is there any room anywhere for a bargaining table here or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Leon Siegel, director of the Northeast Asia Cooperative Security Project for the Social Science Research Council and author of Fighting to a Finish, and Tom Nichols, chairman of the Department of Strategy and Policy at the Naval War College, with us tonight from Newport, Rhode Island. Right now, David's calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call, and I've loved listening to this conversation, although I've been sitting here for a while. I guess the first thing I'd say to preface this is that I think I think personally that this war was a big mistake. However, and with that, and thinking about how you're going to get out of the war, I worry that the fact that this war was not declared makes it very difficult to define your endpoint.
You mean that it wasn't? You mean in the U.S. Congress, and how does that practically affect it?
This is another undeclared war, and it's not clear to me whether our goal is simply the eight objectives that were laid out on day one by the Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. or is our goal actually to destabilize the Middle East, or to establish that this is something that we can do so that all will cower in fear of us and not knock down buildings anymore, or it's becoming fuzzier. And I think that we will have lost. We may have won the battle for Iraq if we end up taking Baghdad and displacing Saddam Hussein. I'm not sure we'll win the war, because I think we will have created for ourselves a peck of trouble.
Well, lots of layers to that question, David, and thank you for it. Leon Siegel, clearly there are some large ambitions in some quarters in Washington that surround this war, but part of ending a war must be about narrowing the context down to a definable set of achievable circumstances.
That's one thing, but the other, the relationship between what happens in Iraq at the end of the war and what happens in Iraq after the war, that is, during the post-war occupation, there's a clear relationship between how this ends and who and what is left in place and what is taken apart. That's very important here. And the second thing is, if we have to apply the kind of force, let's not talk about Grozny, that's kind of the extreme end of it, but if we have to do door-to-door fighting in Baghdad for a period of time, we're going to see a kind of unrest in the Middle East that's going to put pressure on us to want to end the war. And so there's a relationship not only about war aims, but also about how we apply force here.
So you're talking about a region in flames while the Baghdad battle goes on and the U.S. just getting too hot.
Right. And the military actually understands this better than I think some of the civilians talking out of school do, because the military's been very careful about, as careful as they can possibly be, about the application of military force here. The problem is that Saddam won't play our game. He's going to make us overuse force against civilians. That's his game. And that is going to could make this a very difficult ending if you don't have collapse, which we still could have.
Mm-hmm. Tom Nichols, can you imagine a situation where the U.S. comes to desire an end to the war more than Saddam does?
No. And because I think we realize that the one thing that would destabilize the Middle East more than anything and create endless headaches for generations to come is if we go this far and somehow leave Saddam Hussein in power. That would be the most utterly disastrous. If you want to see a region in flames, if the regimes and the people of the Middle East come to believe that the Americans are a paper tiger and that after all of this huffing and puffing, we couldn't get Saddam Hussein, then I think that will simply embolden all of the forces there that are against us. And I should just add that this concern that the Middle East is going to go into flames and there's going to be instability for 100 years and the like, we keep hearing this over and over. We heard it before we went into Afghanistan. Oh, if we invade Afghanistan, it's going to be a nightmare. There are going to be rallies. And there were pro-Osama rallies right up until the minute we started blasting the Taliban to bits, and suddenly the rallies went away. The pro-Osama rallies started
with all due respect, we didn't blast the Taliban to bits. They ran into the hills. Unfortunately, some of them are coming out of the hills now.
Well,
we still have a problem. We still have a problem about controlling Afghanistan, and it will be a long-term problem.
I have to respectfully disagree with you. First of all, judging from eyewitness accounts of people who were actually there fighting the Taliban, I would say blasting into bits is probably a pretty good approximation of what happened. And that regime is not in control of Afghanistan. And Afghanistan, sure, there's still trouble controlling regions of Afghanistan. There will always be trouble controlling regions of Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter is that government is no longer in power and is no longer a regime supporting a terrorist organization.
But Tom Nichols, let me ask you this.
The issue in Iraq is who will control, how long it will take to restore a kind of control over Iraq in the post-war. And that's not something you dismiss easily any more than you dismiss it easily in Afghanistan.
Is
You're
it possible?
Quite right, the government's gone in Afghanistan, and that is a good thing. The problem is that the country is not, if you your word, pacified. It is not pacified. If we face the same kind of problem in Iraq, it is not a good thing. We do not want a long military occupation of Iraq.
Leon Siegel, let me ask you, and I'll ask Tom Nichols as well, but let me put it to you first. Do you have any concern that the United States will not be able to find an end to this war in Iraq, or is that not on your screen?
No, that's not a problem. I think the how we end it and how long it takes and how much instability, nobody said anything about 100 years worth, we get out of the region is the issue, and we don't know the answer to that. We just don't know that.
Tom Nichols, same question to you. Do you have any concern about ongoing guerrilla war, a sense that we just can't find a real peace?
No. I think that there could be instability of a kind that we've seen with harassment. There may be people that take to the hills. I doubt anybody really wants to spend a long time fighting for Saddam once it's clear that Saddam's out of power. But in terms of the conditions of victory, what I was trying to say earlier is one of the things that's very important is can we get permissive access to go anywhere in that country with a regime that is essentially friendly to us to inspect these sites, to disarm Iraq, to get rid of this particular threat that we went in there to go for in the first place. I disagree very strongly with your caller who thinks that there are sort of grand geopolitical designs about reorganizing them. I'm sure there are people in Washington who have such thoughts.
Well, they're quite explicit, and they're not unpowerful.
But in the actual conditions of victory here, in my opinion, and I think the war aims, as they've been set out quite reasonably by the president and the administration, is this regime has to be out of power, these weapons of mass destruction have to be found and destroyed. And I think as long as we can do that, the process of rebuilding Iraq is something that we can work on without being under the gun, without being under the threat of this regime and the kind of activities it supports.
And Leon Siegel, who does the United States sit down with the day after victory is declared?
It'll have to be more than the folks in London, and I think that'll be a hard issue, but that will be an easier issue once we get through and rid of Saddam.
But I mean, who does the U.S. sit down with in Iraq?
Well, I think there are a lot of people, some of them currently with shards of power in Iraq, whom we're unfortunately going to have to sit down with.
You mean Ba'ath Party members or some?
Some people in the Ba'ath Party, certainly some people in the military. Presumably not the thugs, and we know who some of them are, but we're going to have to deal with some of the bureaucrats, some of the party people afterwards.
Saddam's clean comrades, are they out there?
Well, we had to do it in other wars, Germany and Japan. We will have to do it here. The thing that I actually think will be harder than getting rid of Saddam over the long haul is actually to get all the weapons of mass destruction. I think the people who run those programs may have some incentive to keep them underground for some successor regime down the road. And I don't think it'll be very easy to unearth all the weapons of mass destruction or all the weapons programs.
One vista defined, another one rises. We're out of time. Leon Siegel, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Leon Siegel is author of Fighting to a Finish, The Politics of War Termination in the United States and Japan, 1945. And Tom Nichols, chairman of the Department of Strategy and Policy at the Naval War College. Thanks for joining us tonight. Jack Beatty, there we are. Barreling or trying to barrel toward a surrender. And everyone's going to want to declare that victory. Some murkiness about what lies on the other side of the win.
Yes, and how we win. I think the point that Leon Siegel made is very important. If winning means the Battle of Baghdad, and if it's anything like what people are saying, that's losing. And so anything that avoids that, terms of surrender that can get around that eventuality are tremendously to be desired. And if we can stimulate political dynamics within the Ba'athist Party that can get people's incentives right to get rid of Saddam themselves, then we will have done that's what statecraft is all about, figuring that kind of thing out and avoiding this unnecessary suffering in what I think is a tragically unnecessary war.
Jack, stand by. I want to listen to a piece of tape with you. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair laid out his vision for a post-war government in Iraq today. In a speech before the House of Commons, Blair called for the swift creation of an interim Iraqi civilian government. Quote, a post-war Iraq should not be run by the Americans or the British or any other outside power, Blair said. It should be run for the first time in decades by the Iraqi people. Here are excerpts from today's session at the House of Commons.
As soon as possible, Iraq should not be run either by the coalition or by the UN. It should be run by Iraqis. And it should be run by Iraqi people on the basis of a broadly representative government that protects human rights and that is committed to peace and stability in the region. And I am quite sure that is what the vast majority of Iraqi people want to see.
Ian Duncan Smith.
Given the Prime Minister's answer, he also knows that there is a debate going on in the UN with two different views. It appears that the United States government is indicating that they want the UN to endorse a US administration of post-Saddam Iraq, while some European governments are letting it be known that they want the UN itself to run a post-Saddam Iraq. What view does the Prime Minister hold with regard to either one of those two views?
I don't doubt that there are differences within the UN. Certainly my experience in the last few months has taught me that it would be unusual if there wasn't. But I think that those differences are reconcilable if, as I say, we understand that once the conflict ends, of course, the coalition forces will be there. It's then important that we work as coalition forces and as coalition countries in close consultation and partnership with the UN to try to develop the right type of Iraqi interim authority that will be Iraqi in nature. And as I say, I think if we actually understand that it is in everyone's interest to get to the fastest possible point where the Iraqi government is indeed Iraqi, not either UN or coalition force-based, then I think that we will approach the, along the right lines.
Charles Kennedy.
Mr. Speaker, given that the Prime Minister has been to see just within the last few days President Bush on precisely this matter, can he be more specific about what the thinking is? Do he and the President of the United States envisage that the post-conflict administration will be UN-led or American-led? Which will it be?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, as I was trying to say before, what we actually want is to make sure that it is led by Iraqis, by the Iraqi people themselves. And the process of transition from the conflict to that should be done by both the UN and the coalition forces, and that is going to be the necessary thing to do. But the coalition forces are going to be there in the country. There is no way that they're suddenly going to disappear from the ground. And in the immediate aftermath of the conflict, of course the coalition forces will be there. The UN has made it quite clear itself it doesn't want to lead an Iraqi government. What it wants is the ability to work with us in partnership to make sure that we assemble the broadest possible representation from within Iraq itself. And I think, you know, I understand why people want to put these differences between ourselves and the United States, but I think the most intelligent way of proceeding is to recognize that the basic principle is that any transitional arrangements and the Iraqi interim authority has got to be UN endorsed, and the rest of it, frankly, is a matter of working in partnership with the UN, which if we behave sensibly, we should be able to do very easily.
UN endorsed or UN administered or US administered, there's the big post-war question looming in Iraq, Jack.
It is, and that vision of the Iraqis taking over their own future quickly is somewhat in conflict with Secretary Powell's statement. He says, quote, we want a significant dominating control over how that next government in Iraq unfolds. Now, that I think the Prime Minister rightly sees that as a huge political problem in the Arab world. He wants us to do the war, have a short period, and then turn this over to the people themselves to get the taint of illegitimacy and imperialism out of this as quickly as possible.
An awful lot about the world to come to be decided in that debate, Jack.
Indeed.
Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program